Thank you so much, Shira. Thank you, everybody, for being here. I'm excited for this. Even though it sounds somewhat perverse to say that I'm excited for the story we're about to learn today, it is a grand finale. And in many ways, this is where the arguments, the insights, the ideas, the themes that the Book of Judges has been driving over and over again forward and into our understanding of reality all come together in a big crescendo, leaving us both with the devastation that is the, you know, overview of everything that went wrong in this era in our history, but also, as did the rest of the book, with some clues, almost a roadmap of clues for a way to get out of this era, a way to break the status quo, to break the cycle, to break all the horrors that were there. And sorry, I have a young child here, so working on boundaries. I apologize. All of this is leaving us with a sense of how bad it was and with a sense of what needs to be done to make things better. And now without further ado, let us delve in. Well, actually with one further ado, I'll say one more thing. In our course this time, in this learning of Shoftim, we focus on family stories. And other than the marriage of Achsa and Otniel, right, in the very beginning of the book, which had, as far as we know, a happy ending, it was somewhat of a neutral story of marriage and inheritance, every single family we met was dysfunctional or even fell apart in some way. And they all fell apart along three different axes, one could say, or some of them on one over one axis, one others over another axis. Some of them crumbled along the axes of relationship between parents and children. Think about Iftach and his daughter. Think about Micha and his mother. Think even on the milder cases like Shimshon rejecting the good advice of his parents. Or, for example, the priest boy, who's really a Levite boy, who becomes like a son or a father to Micha and then betrays his trust. Another axis of dysfunction, so to speak, was the axis of dysfunction between spouses, between romantic partners. Most notably in the case of Shimshon, where both of his wives betray him, one for fear for her life and one out of greed. But we saw other milder cases throughout. We saw the tensions and apparent distrust between Manoach and his wife. We saw the fact, of course, that Iftach is born of an illegitimate marriage. So clearly there was some tension there between the legitimate wife or wives, depend how we interpret the story, and his mother and so forth. And the third axis of dysfunction we saw come over and over again is a dysfunction in the relationship between brothers. We don't need to go far. Iftach again exemplifies it powerfully when he starts his journey into Jewish history by being banished by his brothers. And then everything he does is haunted by the desire to gain the edge over them, to now be the one in power over them. And he uses this desire for power, for superiority, to establish his new relationship with his people and ends up paying the ultimate price, because when your world is built on power and on pride, people will fall victim, and sometime it'll be your own daughter. And Avimelech, of course, who killed 70 of his brothers on one rock, Nafsad, I think. We don't need to elaborate on that. Interestingly, and I think I've mentioned it before, but here we really start to look at it retrospectively and altogether, each of these axes of dysfunction echoes, encapsulates, mirrors one of the big sins of the era. The dysfunction between parents and children, between generations, in many ways echoes the collapse of memory, the way if each generation failed to pass the lessons it learned to the generations that followed, leaving them without a sense of identity, without a sense of the covenant, and therefore prone to stray from God to other, non-existent divinities, and garner his wrath and lose his protection. the dysfunction between spouses in many ways represents exactly that, the collapse of the covenant, which is often likened in the prophets and the later prophets to the marriage covenant between people and God, and the collapse between brothers, the collapse of trust, love, support between brothers, of course, it's quite literal in the book of Judges when we see time and time again the people fighting against each other, not supporting each other. And it all goes to the very, very beginning of the book when God asked, when they asked God, who should lead us first? And Yehuda took the answer, Yehuda should lead us first, to mean Yehuda should fight their own war, but they didn't take responsibility for the other tribes. They didn't help the other tribes bring about their joint destiny as a people. The story we're about to read today, even though it is a family story first and foremost, becomes a national tragedy, becomes a civil war, and throughout its many stages, which we will now follow, brings together all of these separate fracture lines or fault lines. It brings together the collapse between parents and children. It brings the dysfunction between spouses, the dysfunction between brothers, both on the personal level and on the national level, as if the storyteller of the book, traditionally it's attributed to Shmuel, but regardless, as if the storyteller of the book said, okay, if you didn't get it by now, let me make it really, really obvious for you, dear readers, what the problems are. Let me put them all together and show you how, when the foundation of the personal family and the national house is faulty, is fractured along these fault lines, it cannot stand and things will fall apart. So without further ado, for real now, let us go into the source sheet and meet the family whose collapse we will study today. I am in the first box in the beginning of Judges 19. In those days, when there was no king in Israel, a Levite residing at the other end of the hill country of Ephraim took to himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Yehuda. Now, it should be noted that the fact that he takes her as a concubine and not as a full wife is a little bit of a red flag. So far, we met two concubines or two illegitimate or not fully consecrated marriages in the book of Shoftim. That is the relationship between Gideon and his concubine from Shechem and between Iftach's father and Iftach's mother, and both of them did not end well. And if that is our expectation following this pasuk, we are in fact correct. However, we will see soon that before things get really, really bad, it looks as if they might get better. Not right away, but soon. Once, his concubine deserted him. Now, in Hebrew, it's vatizne alav pilakshu, which is a stronger word than deserted him. It sounds as if she betrayed him with another man, as if she had some sort of sexual indiscretion, leaving him for her father's house in Bethlehem in Yehuda, and she stayed there a full 4 months. Then her husband set out with an attendant and a pair of donkeys and went after her to woo her and to win her back. The word for woo in Hebrew here is ledaber aliba, to speak to her heart. It's a very strong word that implies emotional empathy, emotional communication. She admitted him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he received him warmly. It's not just warmly, vaismach, gladly. He was happy to see him. Now, all of this sounds great. It sounds like the promise of reconciliation again, just as we saw last week in the beginning of the Micha story, when it looks like a mother and a son are about to come together, correcting their estrangement and moving forward together. So it looks like we're about to see some sort of reconciliation, some sort of coming together here. I would say more than that. Because we already reached this point after reading the five books of Moses, I mean, if we're reading the Hebrew Bible in order, we're primed in a sense to believe that when a man takes a woman back, there's a potential of redemption. This is how the story of Moses starts, after all. When a man of the Shevet Levi, right, much like this one, is named a Levite, Ish Levi, a Levite man. The story of Moshe starts when a Levite man takes a Levite woman. And the rabbis assume that it's not really taking her in marriage, but rather remarrying her after being separated. And we know that because he takes her, he gives birth to a child. Well, she gives birth, forgive me, to a child named Moshe. And then he has older brother and an older sister. So where did they come from? And the Midrash famously said that Amram, father of Moshe, divorced his wife when Paro came up with his horrific edict to drown the babies in the river, saying better not to have any babies at all. And his daughter, Miriam, intervened and convinced them that the right thing to do is to continue having children and hope for the best. So when we see another Ish Levi, same words as it's described in Shmot, taking his wife back, his woman back to him, we might think, since we're almost to the end of the book, oh, is that the turning point? Is that the moment when redemption starts? After this long book that started with forgetfulness and war and went from bad to worse, maybe this is a turning point, this reunion. Of course, the bigger our expectation, the happier we are going into it, the more hopeful we are, the more of a shock, more of a devastating shock the following events will be. But even before we get to the really horrific events, the famous horrific events that we will get to, sadly, even the scene that follows directly after the verse I just read with you, the scene of what happens once the concubine and her father and her husband are all in one place for a while, already hints to us that not all is well, and this reunion is not as wonderful as we might think. Because let's see what happens. His father-in-law, the girl's father, pressed him, held him literally, and he stayed with him 3 days. They ate and drank and lodged there. Early in the morning of the fourth day, he started to leave. But the girl's father said to his son-in-law, eat something to give you strength, then you can leave. So the two of them sat down and they feasted together. Then the girl's father said to the man, won't you stay overnight and enjoy yourself? The man started to leave, but his father-in-law kept urging him until he turned back and spent the night there. This is a very long description, right? We have from verse 4 until the end of verse 7, just a description of this hospitality that went for 3 whole days and then for another 4th day that the father yeeked out by luring the husband to stay. The thing that's remarkably missing here, and I wonder if you have noticed that by now yourself, is the woman. What does she do during all those days of partying? What does she think? The husband came to woo her. We don't see any wooing. In fact, we don't see him talking to her at all. After that silent greeting, when she goes out and brings him to her father's house, she might as well not be there for all we know. We have no idea at all. All we know is that the father desires the presence of the husband and the husband lets himself be convinced. But at no point does he turn to his wife and says, do you feel like staying longer? Do you want to go home? What do you think? Do you want some food? It's as if she's a non-entity. The same pattern continues on the 5th day. Let's continue together into verse 8. Early in the morning of the 5th day, he was about to leave when the girl's father said, come, have a bite. Now note again that he was about to leave, not they were about to leave. He is the only one who matters. He is the one moving events. She's an afterthought that's totally absent right now. The two of them ate, and the two of them here are the two men, dawdling until past noon. Then the man, his concubine, and his attendant started to leave. Now, I should say that in Hebrew, the fact that it's his initiative and he's the one basically dragging them along is clear because what it says is, Vayakam ha'ish lalechet, the men rose to leave, hu v'pilakshov v'na'o, he and his concubine and his servant. The action is his. The father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, look, the day is waning towards evening. Do stop for the night. See, the day is declining. Spend the night here and enjoy yourself. You can start early tomorrow on your journey and head for home. But the man refused to stay for the night. He set out and traveled as far as the vicinity of Yevus, that is Jerusalem. Now, where is the wife? Is she with him? Did he leave her behind? Only now, as we know, he already traveled as far as Yavuz, do we go back to hear what on earth happened to her. And we hear he had with him a pair of Latin donkeys. Okay, but where's the wife? And his concubine was with him. She is lower than the donkeys. First, we hear about his travels, his decision to travel, his travels, how far he arrived, about his donkeys. Oh, and by the way, also the concubine. Professor Ali Assis, in his big book about Shoftim, he wrote a beautiful Hebrew book in Shoftim as part of the Maggid series on interpretations of biblical books, points out that this scene of a man coming to woo a woman and ask her to come with him is very reminiscent in significant ways, but different scene in Tanakh. The scene where Eliezer, slave of Avraham, went to woo Rivka for his master's son Yitzhak. Except, while it's similar in the sense that the man coming from afar has to negotiate and interact with the male relatives, and he sits and they host him, and there too they say, "Oh, stay longer, don't leave yet." There's a similar offer of extended hospitality and that delays his leaving. While all of that is the same, the thing that stands out is that Rivka is an active partner in her own marriage contract. The man, her father and her brother, call her to ask her, "Do you want to go?" And she says, "Elech." Furthermore, not only does she have a voice in those negotiations, we're not going to look at it in the sources now, you can later look at it in the source sheet yourselves and see. Not only does she speak up for herself, her father and her brother, both of whom are not exactly characters that we, particularly look up to, especially her brother Lavan, who we meet later at length as a cheat and a deceiver, they still behave as people who have her well-being in mind. They negotiate. They say she should stay here and be taken care of until she's older. We see Eliezer, the man who woos her, even though not for his own sake, actually wooing her, giving her gifts, talking to her, praising her, talking about her good attributes. None of that is happening with this concubine in Bethlehem. We see a father who is entirely focused on talking with his son-in-law and doesn't seem to have any desire to negotiate for his daughter's behalf. We see a husband who, now that he's there, has no interest in hearing what she has to say and seems to have forgotten of her existence beyond treating her almost as baggage to carry with him on his donkeys. And we see her completely silent within her own story. So both the axis between husband and wife and the axis between generations are flawed to start with. And now from this inauspicious beginning, we follow them as they travel. And that delay, the fact that they didn't leave on time, turns out to be very deadly and very dangerous, because it means that they can't get far enough into the mountains, to the land of tribe Ephraim. Instead of getting back to the land where this man, the Levite man, lives, they're still in the Judean and then in the Benjaminite areas south of Hare Ephraim, the mountains of Ephraim, surrounded by strangers when the sun sets. And the question becomes, what should they do? The servant has an idea. The servant says, "Let us go to Yavuz. Here is the Jebusite city, not Jewish city. Let's go there." And the Levite says, No. "I want to go to a Jewish city. I want to go to a Hebrew place." He says, I'm in box 3. I'm reading in verse 12. "But his master said to him, 'We will not turn aside to a town of aliens or not of Israel, but will continue to Gibeah.'" Gibeah was one of the central cities of Benjamin, a very tall city, a city on a tall mountain. You can see far from it. And this faith, this man's faith that it's better to go to an Israelite place, even if it's not of his tribe, than to a non-Israelite place, is very moving in the book of Judges, when we saw the relationship between tribes is not always what it should be. And it turns out to be entirely misplaced, because when they arrive, They stand there in the street, and at first, nobody takes them home to sleep. Nobody offers them hospitality. In many ways, this moment starts to echo the stories we remember from Chumash Bereshit about Sodom, the story about a place where people do not host and do not open their hearts and do not open their doors. But much like in Sodom, a man shows up who acts differently than his surrounding. In this case, it is a man who is himself an outsider. He lives there, but he is not of the same tribe. And when he sees this man and his servant and his concubine and his donkeys in the street, he reaches out to them, much as Lot did to the angel in Sodom. I'm here in box 4. In the evening, an old man came along from his property outside the town. This man hailed from the hill country of Ephraim and resided at Gibeah, where the townspeople were Benjaminites. Perhaps that's why he was more prone to be a host there, to reach out, because he is not of the same culture. He himself knows what it is not to belong. Interestingly, that in itself also makes him very similar to Lot, who was an outsider in Sodom himself, and therefore didn't share in the morals of the city, but rather wanted to host the angels when he saw them. This man, he happened to see the wayfarer in the town square. "Where," the old man inquired, "are you going to, and where do you come from?" He replied, "We are traveling from Bethlehem in Judea to the other end of the hill country of Ephraim. That is where I live. I made a journey to Bethlehem of Judah, and now I'm on my way," wait for this, "to the house of the Lord." That's the first we hear about it. Is he saying that to make himself more important? Is he saying that to convince the men to take him in? Because if someone is making a journey to Shiloh, to the Mishkan, people should respect him? It sure looks like it, because until now, all we knew is that he wants to go home. We never heard that he wants to go to Shiloh. In fact, in Judges, nobody goes to Shiloh. That's part of the problem of the era, that they don't go where they're supposed to go, where they're supposed to receive guidance. Instead, they do whatever they want. However, the man is telling his sob story, and he said, "I am on my way to this important place, and nobody has taken me indoors. We have both bruised straw and feed for our donkeys, and bread and wine for me and your handmaid, and for the attendant with your servants. We lack nothing." Rabbi Nitiel Ziegler says that this was to convince the man that hosting them wouldn't cost them anything. In other words, the expectation at this point is that people wouldn't host if it cost them. People wouldn't take upon themselves expense for other people. But the Ephraimite man, much like Lot, proves himself to be a true descendant of Abraham at heart. He says, "Rest easy," said the old man. "Let me take care of all your deeds. Do not on any account spend the night in the square." And he took him into his house and mixed water for the donkeys. Then they bathed their feet and ate and drank. Sadly, this Lot-like stranger is not the only echo of Sodom that we see. Because what we are about to read in a minute, the events that are about to take place in Gibeah, will echo almost to the word the events that took place when the angels came and Lot took them in and Lot. Let us see those events just so we can, so the comparison is fresh in our mind. I'm still in box number 4, but now in the bottom. Here's what happens when Lot hosts people in his house. They had not yet laid down when the town council and the militia of Sodom, insignificant and influential alike, the whole assembly without exception, gathered about the house, and they shouted to Lot and said to him, "Where are the ones who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may be intimate with them." So Lot went out to them to the entrance, shut the door behind him, and said, "I beg you, my friends, do not commit such a wrong. Look, I have 2 daughters who have not known a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you may do to them as you please. But do not do anything to the others, since they have come under the shelter of my roof." Not exactly what we would call a nice offer or a moral offer, and yet an attempt to protect his guests. Perhaps a misplaced attempt. Definitely a betrayal of his role as his daughter's protector. and horrifically, the same events, the events that happened in a place that was worthy of being destroyed by God, specifically in fire, happened in this Israelite city to which this Levite man turned, thinking it will give him shelter. While they were enjoying themselves, the men of the town, a depraved lot, had gathered about the house and were pounding on the door. They called to the aged owner of the house, "Bring out the man who has come into your house so that we can be intimate with him." The same demand. And now the owner will make the same offer. The owner of the house went out and said to them, "Please, my friend, do not commit such a wrong. Since this man had entered my house, do not perpetrate this outrage. Look, here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out to you. Have your pleasure of them. Do what you like with them, but don't do that outrageous thing to this man." But the man would not listen to him. In the Lot case, the angels were there to save the day. They pulled Lot in when the townspeople were about to attack him. They made everybody around the house blind, and they helped Lot and his family leave the city unharmed. There are no angels here. There's no one to intervene and take action to avert disaster. So instead, the man himself, the man who started this whole story, the Levite man from Har Ephraim, takes matters into his own hand. But it's not himself. He sacrifices. So the man seized his concubine and pushed her out to them. They raped her and abused her all night long until morning, and they let her go when dawn broke. Now, let's pause for a moment. Let's take a step back. These events are very compellingly horrific. I mean, I don't even know how to call it. They're compelling and horrifying. It's hard to stop, but we should for a second and acknowledge what is going on here. What's going on here is that the Israelites themselves, or at least the Israelites residents of this particular city, are proving themselves to be so far removed from everything we're supposed to be that they're no longer content with a little bit of idolatry here, a little bit of sin over there. They are committing sexual, violent crimes as a group together. Not in broad daylight, because we hear that it's nighttime, but publicly, without shame. Now, we might still think that this is a local problem, that this is a particularly difficult town with a particularly disaffected youth group or something like that. If this was the case, it would have been terrible. It would have been horrible. But it would have also been a localized problem, a terrible anecdote. We hear stories like that on the news, and it's terrible and horrible, but it doesn't testify to a deeper trend. It doesn't testify to something on the national scale. Except that if we read the rest of what is to follow carefully, we will see that it's not just the rapists who are in the wrong. It's not just the rapists who are described as the bad guys. Because first and foremost, the person who is about to come out of this story as a cold-hearted person, as the person to be derided, is the husband. Let us imagine for a second ourselves in his shoes, in his sandals, whatever it is they wore them. His concubine, whom he went through all the trouble to get back, is being raped outside all night. Presumably she's screaming. Presumably she's in horrible pain. What does he do? We might imagine him praying to God for deliverance. We might imagine him panicking. We might imagine him bursting, trying to go and save her, and the old man holding him back and saying, "It will end soon. You shouldn't risk yourselves. There will be no point." We might imagine him at least waiting up to let her in as soon as the horrific rape is over. But that's not what happens. As we will discover in the next verse, he very clearly just went to sleep. He didn't even bother waiting up for her. He didn't even bother being there to help her once she would be free of her attackers and violators. Because what we hear in the very next verse, and I'm here now in the same box but lower down, toward morning, the woman came back and as it was growing light, she collapsed at the entrance of the man's house where her husband was. No one was there to open the door for her. No one was there to notice that she's there lying on the threshold until morning. When her husband arose in the morning, implying that he did sleep, he opened the doors of the house and went out to continue his journey. Now, it's not even that he went out to see what happened to his concubine. He went on to continue his journey. She, who has become a silent afterthought already in her father's house, is a silent afterthought here too. He has a journey. He has a plan. She might be there for it. She might not be there for it. He's not checking on her at all. And yet there she is on the threshold. We might expect a little bit of horror from him at this sight, no? And there was the woman, his concubine, lying at the entrance of the house with her hand on the threshold. "Get up," he said to her, "let us go." What a cold thing to say. But there was no reply. So the man placed her on the donkey and set out for home. Professor Assis highlights the fact, I never noticed it until I read it in his book, that at this point we don't know if she's alive or dead. We assume she's dead because clearly the man assumes she's dead. But we don't hear him checking. We don't hear that she's dead. For all we know, she's just unconscious and in need of medical attention, which he doesn't supply. All he does is place her, like so much baggage, on a donkey and go home. And know that even in what happens later, we still don't know if she's alive or dead. When he came home, he picked up a knife and took hold of his concubine and cut her up limb by limb into 12 parts. Was she dead at this point? A disturbing thought that remains undecided. He sent them throughout the territory of Israel. Just a minute. And everyone who saw it cried out, "Never has such a thing happened or been seen from the day the Israelites came out of the land of Egypt to this day. Put your mind to this. Take counsel and decide." Ironically, the torn body of the woman unites the body politic. For the first time since the very beginning of the book of Judges, we will see now a people united, except that the goal that unites them, as we will see, is civil war. It's the tearing apart of the united of the body politics. There's something grotesque. There's something wrong and grotesque about in the foundations of this unity that they create. But before we go there, before we leave the personal story of the concubine and her fate and move to the national story that it initiates and prompts, I want to delay here for a moment. I want to pay tribute to the event itself, to the horror of this event. We have in our history, the image in biblical history, the image of a father holding a knife over his son. And that is, of course, the image of Abraham. And there's a great argument amongst the rabbis that continues to this day as to what exactly was the nisui, what exactly was the thing God was testing for. Was it Abraham's obedience? Was Abraham's obedience problematic? Should he have argued against God when God told him to kill his beloved son, Yitzchak? Did Abraham do it knowing that God is going to stop him, or did he do it thinking he really is about to kill his son? So much in this scene is opaque. But what we do know is that in that very moment when he stands with a knife, the angel of God calls to Abraham and says, "Abraham, Abraham," and Abraham stops. He is open to hear God's contrary command. He is open to hear the voice that tells him, actually, everything that seemed like it's going this way now is going the other way, and you don't need to kill your son. And Rabbanit Aviva Zornberg, in one of her lectures on this topic, highlights this openness of Abraham as the moment of nobility, the moment that marks him as a truly exceptional man. Because many of us, when we work ourselves up to do something difficult, we close ourselves. We get locked into the path. And Abraham, even in his hardest personal moments, is always open to hear that voice, to hear that call, to hear the thing that says, wait, change directions. This is not the path. Even when God himself set him on this path. So when we see the man holding his knife over his concubine, and the echo of Avraham rises in the background, and we think of Avraham was so open to hear God, to hear the suffering of other people, to hear the feeling of loneliness and need and privation of travelers in the desert, and run and bring them into his house. He is casting an enormous shadow, and in a sense casts himself as a counter or a dark mirror, or I should say the other way around. The Levite man is the dark mirror to this extreme openness, because here is this Levite man, entirely deaf in heart to his wife's suffering, entirely apathetic to her pain, entirely unopen to show her the least bit of compassion in her pain, and possibly murdering her at this point, because until this point, we didn't even ascertain if she's alive or dead. For him, she was an object long before he took her body and physically turned it into an object to awaken revulsion amongst other people so that they would muster and come to his aid. She was an object for him from the beginning. And when people are objects to one another, the family cannot stand and the nation cannot stand. As we see, follows in the next set of events. The people muster, they come to the men's call. The man tells them his story, and we don't have time to look at it in detail, but he tells them the story in terms that cast him as the tragic hero and victim and caring husband. And they don't even question. They don't even go through checking. They're so affected by the rhetoric of victimhood and revulsion that they immediately set out, unite, and demand that the people of Benjamin will surrender the perpetrators to them. Now, here comes a murky moment, because there's reason to believe that the Benjaminites weren't completely wrong in rejecting this request. Up until now, every tribe adjudicated their own matters on their own. Every now and then, a judge would rise up, would be a center for more than one tribe, like Korah, all those chapters of before ago. But overall, every tribe managed their own affairs. So by what right do the Israelites come to the Benjaminites and say, we want to punish the rapist amongst you? Maybe if they would have said, we expect you to punish people who do such terrible things amongst you, history would have been different. But one of the things we see over and over and over again in the book of Judges, and really culminates here very powerfully, is that people don't bother taking the time to communicate empathetically and properly. With some exceptions, Gideon, when the tribe of Ephraim comes and is angry at him for not calling them to arms, finds a way to appease them. But he is, if anything, an example that shows how everybody else, Yotzemin Eklala Meid Al Eklala, as you say in Hebrew, that he was exceptional to the rule and teaches us that the rule is very, very different. Because in time and time again and time again, we see that the people don't communicate empathetically with one another. When Iftach is faced with similar accusation, he kills 42,000 people. When people approach him from his own tribe, he responds to them harshly, and in a self-centered sort of way. And this, it shines through here in this dialogue, when the people demand that they will have the power to punish. The Benjaminites close ranks and say, you will not take these men who are part of us and punish them. And for the first time in the whole book, the people finally unite, except, of course, one tribe, and stand together in box 6. Thereupon, all the Israelites from Dan to Beersheba in the land of Gilad marched forth, and the community assembled to a man before the Lord in Mitzpah, except that in Hebrew, that's not what it says. In Hebrew, it says, Ke'ish Echad, as one man, which famously is what description we attribute to the people in Mount Sinai, when we stood as one man to receive God's words. Now, with this grotesque unity a unity that is entirely formed for the purpose of tearing apart the people, comes also a grotesque, almost tikkun, almost correction of the ancient primal error that started the cycle of horrors of the whole book, the error of not interpreting God's answer to their question fully. Let me explain. Back then, they went to God in the beginning of the book of Judges, the very first verses, and says, "Mi ya'aleh lanu tchila? Who shall rise first for us?" God says, "Yehuda." And Judah takes it to mean that they should fight their war first, but they don't take responsibility for anybody else. Here they ask the same question. They get the same answer. And this time, tribe Judah leads the whole people, sans Benjamin, in war. Let's just see that together briefly. In box 6, they proceed to Bethel and inquired of God. The Israelites ask, "Who of us shall advance first to fight Benjaminites?" And the Lord replied, "Judah first." Interestingly, they then go to war, apparently under God's auspices, right? You would expect they would win, except for 2 days, they suffer terrible, terrible losses. And the rabbis, I'm trying to untangle why they're losing when God answered their question, seemingly lending his support to the campaign, point out that they never asked God if they should go for this war. They just asked, "Who should lead us first?" And by allowing them to suffer the consequences, God, in a sense, is teaching them a very painful and exhaustive lesson, reminding them that as important as it is to obey God, it is also important to ask the right questions. And by asking, why is it important? It's not just a technicality. It's just a matter of, a trick problem. Oh, you didn't ask the right questions. I'll take points for that. Bloody, bloody points. No. It's very, very revealing and important that what they're asking is who shall go first and not should we go? Because what it means is that they are so set on their course of destroying Shevet Binyamin that they are not open to hear other directions. Much as the man wasn't open to hear anything, to hear his wife's fame, his concubine's fame, unlike Abraham, they are unopen to listen to what is the right path to do. They think they know. Every person does what is right in their own eyes. And what's right in their own eyes is civil war. And civil war is not God's way. And yet that is what they do. Eventually, when they actually pray and promise all kinds of things and bring sacrifices, God grants them victory. And even more interestingly, instead of bringing about joy, this victory brings about an awakening of sorrow. Because if during the war they are so set on their path of destruction that they don't recognize the innate horror of what they're doing, the fact that they're destroying a tribe in Israel, their own brothers, when they actually win, when all who survive from the entire tribe of Benjamin are 600 men. Understand what it means. No women and children survive. Only those 600 men. When that's all that's left of a thriving tribe in Israel, suddenly the people are forced to look at what they did, recoil, and realize that they've been asking the wrong questions all along. Except that then their horror is compounded. Because in the heat of war, they didn't simply march to battle day after day after day. They also made an oath. An oath that now they realize was a terrible idea. And the oath was to never let any of their daughters marry a man of Benjamin. And now, when the war is won, and only those 600 Benjaminite men survive, the men realize what the meaning of their oath is. They realize that their oath means the destruction, the extinction, I should say, of Benjamin's descendants forever. Because if there's no Benjaminite women and no non-Benjaminite women are allowed to marry Benjaminite men, there will be no Benjaminite children. And in that way, the book takes what happened in a sense with Iftach already. We already saw a man make an oath that leads him to victory and then come to realize that this oath is about to bring destruction of his home. So the people, with the oath that brought them to victory, are now brought to understand that this will bring the destruction of their home, the national home, by bringing to extinction, a crucial part. Now, if you recall, when we discussed Iftach, one of the things we noted was that his oath halachically doesn't hold water. It should have been resolved. He should have gone, if he didn't know the laws of oaths, he should have gone to our rabbi. He should have gone to Pinchas HaKohen, who was the religious leader of the era. He should have found someone more knowledgeable who would have told him, your oath doesn't apply because God doesn't want human sacrifices. And if it applies, then there must be a way to unmake it legally. And yet, instead of seeking such a path, instead of finding a peaceful, life-oriented, healing-oriented solution, Iftach felt so bound by his own speech, by his own hasty, careless speech, that he carried it out to the results, to the bloody results promised, and either killed or isolated his own daughter for the rest of her life. Much like it, the Israelites don't seem to see a peaceful way out of their oath. Instead, they come up with two horrific solutions. The first has the curious attribute of solving one problem with another. Because along with that terrible oath about their daughters, they also made an oath during the war that if there's any Jewish Israelite city who doesn't come to support them in their civil war against Benjamin, they will kill everyone in that city. So as they are there crying and lamenting the coming extinction of Benjamin, suddenly they have the brilliant idea to check if any city failed to send soldiers. And then they see that Yavesh Gilad on Transjordan didn't send soldiers, just didn't participate in the civil war. And instead of praising them for not wanting to participate in the massacre, what do? They go and kill everyone in that city except 300 girls who were too young to have known a man, and they give those girls, those newly orphaned, newly traumatized survivors of a massive massacre in their city, they give them to the Benjaminite men. But they recognize that this is not enough of a solution because this is still not enough women, and it's not a long-term solution for the coming generation. And so they come up with a very famous solution that somehow became enshrined in Tu B'Av, the 15th of Av, that is celebrated as a holiday of love, yet its roots are not exactly what I think you and I would call romantic. Let us read it together in the text. Oh, I'm in the wrong place, excuse me. Just a second. Here. I'm going to go down to box 8. Here. So the elders of the community asked, what can we do about wives for those who are left since the women of Benjamin have been killed off? For they said there must be a saving remnant for Benjamin, that a tribe may not be blotted out of Israel. Yet we cannot give them any of our daughters as wives. Since the Israelites have taken an oath, cursed be anyone who gives a wife to Benjamin. They said, the annual feast of the Lord is now being held at Shiloh. And now there's an odd description of exactly where Shiloh is. It lies north of Bethel, east of the highway that runs from Bethel to Shechem, and south of Levona. So they instructed the Benjaminites as follows. Go and lie in wait in the vineyards. As soon as you see the girls of Shiloh coming out to join in the dances, come out from the vineyards. Let each of you seize a wife from among the girls of Shiloh and be off for the land of Benjamin. In other words, the solution to a war that started from the collapse of one family home is to establish family homes on kidnapping, on forceful taking of women without consent. The story of a rape that was avenged in this terrible way is somehow supposed to be ameliorated through acts that are very close to rape in themselves for perpetuity, forevermore. This is not a new pattern in biblical history. Already in the time of the Mabul, when the time where people took whatever they wanted, including women, including sexual pleasure and gratification. They took however they wanted from whoever they wanted. Might was the only right, so to speak. The rabbis in their commentary on that time say that whenever there is aggressive sexual violations, whenever it becomes habitual for people to take whoever they want, however they want, what happens is that andrelamusia, a topsy-turvy reality comes into the world that in the end kills both the good and the bad. And we see it time and time again that rape, violent rape in Tanakh, almost never remains as an isolated incident. Think of Dinah. It starts with one woman being raped and ends with an entire city with both innocent and not innocent people in it raised to the ground, and the women of that city taken as slaves by the sons of Jacob. Think of Tamar, sister of Avshalom and David's family. Her rape ends up leading to a civil war where innocent and non-innocent are dying, and the rape of her father's concubines on the roof by his own son. We see the same pattern repeating, and this is one of its classic, I should say, repetitions, where the rape of one woman then ripples out into indiscriminate slaughter and ends with more sexual aggression instead of less. What it tells us is that here, in the very finale of the book, the people of Israel fail at breaking free from the reality they're part of. The reality they're living continues to shape their solutions, even when they're trying to make things better. So here they are coming together out of moral outrage, which in itself, I want to point out, is a good thing. It means that this is not normal for them. They're not okay with mass rape happening in the streets of a city. That is a good thing. But they don't have a way to translate this moral outrage into something constructive, into changing and healing the fabric of society. All they can do is use more force and perpetuate the same patterns even when they try to solve the problems that the anarchy, immorality, and lack of communication of the era creates. And as if to put it all in perspective and nudge us towards a correct understanding of where we should go from here, the book ends again in these words. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did as he pleased. Isha yeshel be'enav yaseh. There's no center. There's no guidance. There's no leadership. And reality crumbles when this is life. Now, everything I said until now is very dramatic. It feels kind of, you know, like we're reaching a point where we can look at the book and say, okay, we get the point, except for two problems. One, the solution that the book seems to be pushing us towards doesn't solve the problem. We mentioned that a little bit last night. But if the problem is immorality, right? If the problem is a collapse of a covenant with God, if the problem is that the people don't remember who they are and who they should be, why would a king change that? We know that there are many kings in our history who, if anything, led the people more astray, more or farther away from covenant with God, if anything. Why would it solve anything to have a king? And the other problem with this ending, with this dramatic ending, is that it seems to tell us that we need a man to come and be king to solve the problem. But people tried. It's not just that we know that kings don't solve these sorts of problems. It's also that we saw people trying to do it. We saw Avimelech taking the kingship. We saw the Shoftim, one after another, trying to lead the people. And that didn't work. that didn't actually change reality for the better long term. So instead of finishing the book with a clear sense of a solution, we end it with a solution that feels misleading, that feels like it's not the top for the right pot, so to speak. However, if we start to look back and tie all the different strands and all the things that we notice, we will see that while the book ends explicitly saying that what we need is kingship, or hinting that what we need is kingship, what it's been telling us all along is what kind of kingship we need. The king can help create a centralized government. He can, as we said last week, as Professor Assis says, he can stop local problems from becoming civil, rippling out into a civil war. The king can do a lot of things. But to really succeed, a king needs to be certain things, or needs to address certain challenges that the Book of Judges created a map of. One challenge is the lack of communication, the way people don't talk properly to one another. And sometimes when they say something, they then feel that they're bound to what they said, and that others, they just don't bother communicating at all. A king will need to be able to create the kind of connections that allow people to communicate across tribal and across socioeconomical lines. A king will need to be able to think of solutions that break the status quo instead of perpetuating it, that break the cycle of violence instead of killing yet another city or basing yet more families on violence and kidnapping and perhaps rape. A king will need to be, therefore, original, someone who thinks outside of the reality as it is, outside of the box, and compassionate and passionate, someone who forms a lot of relationships. And with these two clues, if we carry them with us into the coming books of Tanakh, first Megillat Rut, and then the Book of Shmuel, we will discover that while the Book of Judges left us with a heavy impression of a difficult era without solutions and without hope, it also gave us the criteria that will illuminate, or that will help us understand why Shaul will fail and why David will be the right king. And before we round up today's session, I want to point out that there's a little literary hint hiding in our story to the fact that we need to wait for David and for the rise of the Davidic era to really break away from the status quo of Shoftim, to take all the good intentions, all the attempts at reconciliation, and successfully use them to elevate the era into something new. And the hint lies, and here, let me reopen the source sheet, in the fact that the story begins with an encounter between someone, a Levite man who lives in Har Ephraim, and someone from Bethlehem, Yehuda. We already saw an encounter like that last week when we discussed Micha. There it was an encounter between Micha, who lives in Ephraim, and a Levite man from Bethlehem, Yehuda. So we saw two encounters like that, and every time they seemed like they're offering redemption only to end in disaster. But by the rules of three, which is a basic rule of storytelling, that the third time something happens, everything changes, we can expect that the next time an encounter like that, a juxtaposition of those three things, a Levite man, someone from Ephraim, and someone from Bethlehem Yehuda, reality will change. And the next time this kind of encounter happens is when Shmuel, who was a Levite man from Ephraim, goes to anoint a young boy from Bethlehem Yehuda, a boy named David. And with that moment, with that encounter, the man who is capable of thinking beyond the status quo and forming relationships across the people finally arises and starts to elevate us out of the conundrum that this book, with its difficult family histories, portrayed. And may all tragedies and all difficult times turn out to be roadmaps towards redemption in the same way. Thank you, everybody. I will take some of your questions now. I just wanted to finish in time for those who have to leave.
Are there any commentators that look at the girls going out to the field as being of their own free choice? These girls went willingly. They were looking for husbands. And maybe like that seizing isn't really a negative word in Hebrew. Is there anything
that... There are some commentators. There are some midrashim that suggest that. They're not conclusive in the sense that it's not... It doesn't seem to describe all of reality. Let's put it this way. It definitely seems that some cases were like that. In fact, there's a famous midrash that Shaul was, after all, Shaul was a son of Benjamin, right? And that he was so shy that he didn't want to kidnap a woman. But he went there and he's supposed to get a wife this way. And he doesn't want to. His would-be wife had to go and kind of kidnap him. It's a very interesting midrash that illuminates some of his reticence, which doesn't serve him well as a king, but also marks him as an excellent person and some of the interesting tension in his character. I have to say, by the way, that Shaul as a character hangs over, haunts a lot of the descriptions we read. He was from Gibeah. He united the people by tearing apart cows into 12 pieces and sending them about around, but for a good purpose of coming together to defend another Israelite city. That is an aside. In answer to your question, it's ambivalent. I think that if we're reading just the pshat, it's hard not to see it as a violation, as a violent sort of occurrence, because part of the idea of negotiations, you know, we don't like it, the idea that parents negotiate and basically sell their daughter to a husband. And definitely in some cases, as we saw in the concubines case, it doesn't go very well if the father who leads a negotiation doesn't take her interest in heart to heart. But part of what it guaranteed was that a woman wouldn't end up with a husband who can't support her, who is totally different from her family, who is perhaps violent. That was part of the idea of these negotiations, was to protect women from that. So by skipping these negotiations, you're creating a situation that maybe sometimes was absolutely benevolent and even consensual, but is very open for abuse. I hope that addresses your question.
Yeah, sure.
Susanna Levin wrote, Melech En, what does the government has got to do with it? So I hope we addressed that already a little bit. I would like to add that while I think that the idea that a king is somehow going to be on his own, the magic solution to all the problems, is obviously not true and doesn't align even with some of the stories we saw of very problematic leaders throughout the book of Judges, it's also true, at the same time it is true, that central government allows certain things to run more smoothly. For example, makes sure that people adhere to certain laws. For example, don't attack people in the streets. You know, don't threaten a member of your own city that you will grab people out of his house. And also, regarding the other sin of the era, the sin of forgetfulness, central government historically often comes with a concentration of knowledge. And once the knowledge is concentrated in the capital, in the king's court, it's passed on from generation to generation more effectively. And we do see that, by the way, in the era of the kings, with all its problems, with all its evil kings who abuse the people or stray away from God and take the people with them towards idol worship. We do see that memories pass from generation to generation much more effectively. So yeah, that does, I think, make a difference.
At the beginning of the story, it says, Umelech Ein B'Yisrael, something like that. So we already knew that. So why is it repeating it?
I think it's because it's a refrain. It's, you know, most of the book, after the first two chapters, had a structure. And the structure was, the people abandon God, God abandons them, they suffer under another nation, they call out, God sends a judge, the judge dies, they sin and abandon God, and so on. In the last few chapters, this structure collapses reflecting, in a sense, how this society itself collapsed. But it's replaced by another structure. And this structure is more of a refrain, the refrain that there is no king, there is no king, woven into everything, so that at every stage, as we watch it on the local level, the collapse of families, and then on the tribal level, and then on the national level, we remember that this is what happens when there's a vacuum of leadership. This is the reality. And it percolates throughout. You know, we talked a lot in this course about how families represent the nation, how what happens to a family mirrors what happens to the nation, but also families are amongst the victims of what happens to the nation. When the nation collapses, the little people suffer, the little families, the families, the actual families suffer and fall apart. Ben Ben Melech wrote, she gained strength and leverage by going back to her father's house, especially wooing, maybe better treatment. If only, right? I mean, it's in the beginning, it looks like it might be the case that he is coming to woo her. She has the power. And yet we see right away that she doesn't, in fact, have the power, that she's treated as a total afterthought and someone who's not, doesn't need to be consulted. I see that Sima Herzberg called the Sdom, Lot, and Akeda language before we even discuss that. I'm going to go ahead a little bit, just a minute. Shelley Shapiro asks a very important question. Is this story of the Pelagic in chronological order? Is this historically the last happening in Shoftim? The answer is no. And this is an important point, so I'm glad you raised that. Most traditional commentators and academic researchers are pretty convinced that the stories at the end of the Book of Judges actually happened very early on in the era of the Judges. And we see that because some of the leaders at the time and some of the leadership patterns and the way things are run are things that are related to the generations immediately after Yeshua. In other words, the book is not in order. And Professor Assis makes a very, sorry, it's not Professor Assis, I forgot. I don't remember, but someone whose name I'm afraid shall be unknown makes a very interesting point in his analysis of this. He says, if the story was in order, right, it would have started by Yehoshua. And then after Yehoshua dies, these people still work together. For example, when one of the tribes transgresses, they come together to punish them. And then slowly, as time passes, they fall apart into smaller and smaller units, where judges show up and save them from time to time. And then the emphasis of the whole book would have been geopolitical, how over time, with lack of leadership, we can no longer work effectively together. But the book doesn't want that. The storyteller of the Book of Shmuel wants to end on the moral note, on the moral collapse, almost as if to highlight that the underlying problem throughout the book was not a question of leadership, was not a question of unity alone. It was always a question of the people's morals, of how they perceive themselves and what guides them, what morals, what ethics, what ideas of what God wants from us in the world guide them. And this is the problem from beginning all the way to this devastating, chronologically misplaced.
Rachel, that's a beautiful, beautiful way to end this series. I know many of us have more to say, have more questions. We do have Shuli Mishkin joining us. Her class is set to begin in a few minutes. So I also think it's, you know, it leaves things unsaid and it leaves the door open for you to come back and grace us with more. And I think that was just so well put and a beautiful way to finish this series. On behalf of Torah in Motion and everybody here, I would just like to say thank you. We're also grateful. This was just chock full of so much to talk about, to think about. And as I said, what a beautiful thought to end your series on. Thank you so much. Thank you to everyone for being here. And you're all invited to stay on. Shuli Mishkin will be beginning her class. Mount Scopus is our neighborhood, our topic for this class. And we will be beginning in a few minutes. Those of you who are staying on from Rachel's class, I invite you to take a moment to, you know, to step away if you need to. And Shuli will begin in about 2 minutes. Rachel, thank you again.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Sarah. Thank you,
Fantastic.
It was wonderful to study with
Excellent. Wonderful.
Thank you.